all for coming. I'm Jason Kaufman. This is Kevin Lewis, and we're two of the principals on this project, Social Networks and Online Spaces. And the reason we're here is we're trying to affiliate with the Berkman Center. This is an ongoing project that has just received funding from the National Science Foundation. And we need to find an institutional home for the grant. And we also are inspired by the interdisciplinary of the center. We're sociologists. And every time I come here to the Berkman Center, I learn 10 new things. So clearly the project would have a nice home to grow here. So our research site is Facebook and only Facebook. We chose that for a few different reasons. Kevin Marco Gonzalez and I met in fall of 2005 to start a research project. And at that time, everybody was talking about Facebook. And it seemed clear that just about every college student in America was an active Facebook user. So we thought opportunistically, we might as well dip into this data stream and try to extract from this data set on Facebook users. So in effect, what we did is we picked a university location that would have us. And we downloaded the Facebook profiles of every member of the freshman class. 97 or 98% of students in this class were using Facebook. So from a sociological perspective, this is very unique data in that it's a complete social universe. You know all the possible connections and absence of connections between the students in a cohort of college students. These are students living in the same physical space and interacting. So in March of 2006, we sat down to draw this data. Now, one limitation. In order to start this, we needed to get IRB approval. The university in question allowed us to do this, and Harvard was on board because we don't actually talk to students. We just access their Facebook information. But one of the requirements of the IRB was that we contact Facebook and ask permission. We are lucky. In 2005, Facebook was still sort of basking in its youth and said, sure, go ahead. The one limitation they put on us was that we couldn't automate a search. So essentially, we couldn't scrape. What that meant is that we basically have to sit by hand and save the content of these pages, then clean and convert it into machine code, and then we can use it, analyze it in social network analysis software. One of the things that would obviously be useful to talk to folks at the Berkman Center is ways that we might negotiate better access. If we could get this data from Facebook, we could do a data draw once a month or once a week instead of once a year. But at this point, we physically do this by hand. We continue doing it every March, and so we now have three different slices in time of this same complete cohort of college students. And in the upcoming March, we'll do this once more. We do have a few publications under review at the Journal Social Networks and the Journal of Computer Mediated Communication. I'll talk about those briefly. We did happen upon some mixed press last December, just before Christmas. The New York Times contacted us and actually ran a cover story. This is our colleague Nick Christakis, whose picture was about this big in the Times. And the story was trying to dust up some controversy, saying, are these college professors invading the privacy of college students by downloading their Facebook data? So we ended up being interviewed on BBC and Canadian television and NPR, sort of people trying to bait us into saying something culpable. Fortunately, we're really not abusing these students at all. All the data is cleaned, so you can't connect anyone to an identity. The data itself has a few very unique properties, both for us and for the community of people interested in studying the internet. One advantage to using Facebook is that it's a natural research instrument. When you want to gain information about people through surveys or questionnaires, you're putting them in an experimental position. It obviously shapes the nature and quality of answers you get. Our respondents are entering this information about themselves on Facebook without any intercourse with us whatsoever. So they're producing this information naturally. It should be more representative. We have 4 years of data, which obviously we'd like more, but for sociological standards, that's actually pretty good to have four different slices in time of a social network emerging. Again, we have complete network data, on this entire cohort of college students. And these folks were born about 1987. It's the college class of 2009. So in a sense, these are digital natives. There's a great deal we can learn from that perspective. Perhaps the most innovative feature of the data is that we've collected information about multiple types of social tie. The most obvious thing to do would be to record how many Facebook friends people have and what their Facebook connections are throughout their college class. But we all know it's hard to interpret the meaning of a Facebook friend. At a minimum, you could assume, in most cases, if two people are Facebook friends, they have at least met face-to-face once, probably, hopefully more. But it's a measure of a weak degree of relationship. So we did two other, we studied two other types of ties. One of the things people can do in Facebook is put pictures up and label who are in their pictures. So we downloaded all this data, and it actually creates what we call bidirectional social network tie data, in that we know if Kevin and I are friends, our data will tell you if I have pictures of Kevin on my Facebook page, if he has pictures of me, or both. Clearly, the three different options have different implications. So we consider the presence of a picture tie relationship a stronger sign of friendship. You have to more than be acquainted with somebody, in all likelihood, to be in a picture with them on your or their website, their Facebook site. And the third type of data, which is really unique, is we wanted some way to connect internet space to real space. And we negotiated with the administrators of this college access to information about where all of these students lived. So we know physically where everyone lives in each of the 4 years through the study, so that we can see the connection between physical proximity, emerging roommate and friendship groups in the quote-unquote real world, and the presence of these two types of relationships in their Facebook space. Yeah?
Was it just looking at the photos and reciprocal tagging on that, or did you also analyze, like, wall posts?
We ultimately were not able to analyze wall posts, A, because of the amount of extra effort, and we found that they're actually kind of a wonky measure, and that often there's repeated redundancies in that.
Yeah.
It would have been nice.
It's a different kind of dialogue, obviously. Yeah. But
it would be nice, but we don't have it. The one real, I'm a cultural sociologist. I'm also a sociologist of law, so it's particularly fruitful for me to be here. But one of the beauties of Facebook in particular is that it prompts users to list their favorite movies, music, broadly defined, and books. So we have three different sources of data on people's tastes and cultural proclivities, which, when matched with their relational data and attributes like their gender, their race, their hometown, can actually is quite a powerful data set. And the last feature, NSF has required in exchange for the grant that we make this data all publicly accessible. So by the time we finish, there will be a data set at the Harvard-MIT Data Center that anyone who's a qualified researcher, people have to check in with us and sign a license agreement. But essentially, anyone who wants to research with this data will be able to use it. And clearly, we won't even, our group won't scratch the surface of the number of interesting things one can examine. So I'll tell you briefly some of the things that we've started looking at. This is just a quick picture of one dormitory of freshmen and several of the possible linkages. Where the rubber really hits the road is moving from graphical depictions like this to actually using mathematical techniques to analyze the structure of the data. Kevin Lewis is the genius behind the work we do on that. From our perspective, sociologists have come a long way in developing analytical tools to study social structure, but they have relatively weak data. And so we think there'll be a lot of interest in using our data simply because it's better social network data than almost anyone has presented to date. So this is a paper that we have under review, a team of us, where we're actually looking at which students invoke their privacy settings on Facebook. Now, this is a case of finding opportunity and constraint. The diffusion of privacy settings makes our job as data collectors more difficult, right? Because we sometimes find that we can't get the information we want. But we decided it would be interesting to actually examine who's using their Facebook settings and the social attributes thereof. So this is just a snapshot, 1 year time passing. Red dots are people who use a privacy setting, and you can see the tremendous proliferation over that time. Getting into more detailed findings, we do indeed find that if you are friends with somebody who uses privacy settings, you are more likely to use privacy settings. So there is, in fact, some form of network effect here, though how exactly this diffuses would require more qualitative data. We also found that students who use private profiles are disproportionately female, which seems to be a result of seeking privacy and a fair degree of public safety, being cautious with who can see your data. We have a measure of a very rough proxy of how often a person is using their Facebook account. People who are more frequent Facebook users are more likely to have a privacy option invoked. And here's where our sociological brains begin to kick in hypothesizing. We find, so in terms of the taste data, there are two very simple measures we can use. So basically, we're developing an association metric of not only who's friends with whom, but who shares tastes in common. And from that, we can derive for each individual a mean taste score and a standard deviation of their taste score. The mean roughly tells you how popular their tastes are. A high mean would say their tastes are shared in common by a lot of members of their college class. And a low mean would say your tastes are pretty esoteric. A low standard deviation, a small standard deviation, would say your tastes tend to be clustered in one part of the spectrum. So if you have a high mean and a low standard deviation, you like lots of popular tastes and only popular tastes. A bigger standard deviation would mean you have a broader spectrum of tastes relative to the other members of your college cohort. What we found is that students with popular tastes and only popular tastes in music tended to be more likely to use privacy profiles. From this, you could extrapolate. The students with esoteric tastes, random punk bands from Sacramento in the 1970s, say, they are using Facebook as a means of public display. So they do not want to invoke privacy and prevent strangers from seeing how cool they are. We're stretching what our data can tell us here, but we think we might be touching on a sort of sensibility. A certain type of Facebook consumer is using this for active self-presentation and is therefore less concerned with the trade-off between privacy and publicity. Yes? A second project that Kevin is doing with one of our colleagues, Andreas Wimmer from UCLA, is looking at homophily, or who is associated with whom in this college cohort. What are the social bases of affiliation? And the primary lens of the research is to examine the salience of race. We hear a lot about racial self-segregation on campuses, black students living and dining with black students, Asian students with Asian students. The Facebook data actually lets us look one level deeper than race, in that we know what types of clubs people are interested in, and we have pictures of people. So we had several undergraduate coders code what they perceived to be the race of each respondent based on their photos, and also they incorporated data on what clubs they were members of. So Black Students Association, East Asian Students Association, South Asian, for example. And one of the things they found is that race is important for some groups, black students, for example. But if you look at Asian students, the picture gets infinitely more complicated. Students of Japanese origin and students of Vietnamese origin really perceive themselves to have no connection and aren't more likely to be socially connected just because they're quote-unquote Asian. And this is another way of graphically representing the data. Basically, the height of a cone is how many people are members of a certain club, and that's its breadth, and its height is how cohesive that connection is. Cone 16 is Vietnamese students, and you can see there are not a lot of Vietnamese students on this campus, but they are all friends with one another. There's a very high consistency, and so in this paper, they're trying to unpack various dimensions. People that have different cultural proclivities are more or less clustered. So being interested in hip-hop seems to be a source of affiliation, more so than an interest in jazz or an interest in classical music. There are some clusters by people's discipline. Cone 10 are people that graduated from a select group of prep schools. So as sociologists, there's a whole other dimension to affiliation matrices. The final project that I'll talk about today, Kevin and I are working on with Marco Gonzalez, and here we're focusing on the taste data and trying to ask very basic questions, does having a similar proclivity in movies or music or books make you more likely to be friends with a person? Are your tastes more likely to evolve in concert with people you're already friends with? We do find that there's a consistent non-random effect of being friends with somebody, that you are more likely to have books, music, and movies in common. Interestingly, though, this is a pretty important finding, different types of media have different social structures. So we find that having books in common is really a less important component of homophily, of affiliation, than music or movies. And we're beginning to try to think of creative ways to study this. A second issue is how people's tastes relate to their social structural position. So a common question in sociology is, in order to be an elite in American society, you need to have knowledge of classical music, or so-called highbrow arts. Is being interested in lowbrow culture somehow debilitating or advantageous? And there are a variety of different social network measures that you can actually assess the strategic utility of a person's social structural position. So the mantra in social network studies is what we call the strength of weak ties. And this basically means that the most useful people to you are not your friends or family, but friends of friends, friends of family. People who connect you to social domains outside your proximate social universe. This has been proven time and time again. The most likely people find jobs, find romantic partners, find roommate situations are through people 2 or 3 degrees removed from themselves. And one thing we've looked at is the structural position of people of different racial groups, for example. So we found that black students are in a structurally advantageous position in college campuses, and that they bridge groups that otherwise don't have much in common. They'll have friends, let's say, with Asian students and white students who don't intersect, and black students are brokers. The people with the most advantageous position from a racial point of view are mixed race students, which probably not surprising.
Uh-huh. Structural rules.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty fascinating to be documenting this with real data. A book that I'm working on and a topic that I've been teaching on for many years at Harvard, I've been teaching a class called Media in the American Mind for the last 9 years, focuses on what this says about American society and how we could generalize about the social character of digital natives in America. And I've taken to trying to explore a term I call micro-directedness. And this is a sense of finding group affiliation in niches that are based on having common consumer tastes and identity profiles. So this would be akin to people who are interested in hip-hop finding one another and having both online and physical relationships. So the pragmatics here are that we've received this NSF grant for 2 years. I'm the PI, and I'm currently institutionalist for a variety of reasons. And so we need, an affiliation, particularly a place like this where we can exchange ideas, get feedback, talk to people doing related research in the internet. And from a practical standpoint, the NSF requires that we run our grant through an institution. And we think that the Berkman Center would be an ideal place to do this. Physically, what we really need is payroll. We have office space in the sociology department and the computer hardware we need. But we need a place from which to pay ourselves and a place from which to continue to spur new dialogue about this research. Yeah.
So this may be a little hard because you're not necessarily too plugged into all the Berkman things.
Yeah.
But this sounds like a tremendous fit with a lot of the things that are going on here, digital natives, and a bunch of the other more cultural, you know, social science-y kind of projects that we have. And from my standpoint, it sounds like there'd be a huge amount of great cross-fertilization back and forth. Do you have any sense from what you know of Berkman already of how you might be able to plug what you're doing into some of the existing projects and sort of what you would be prepared to do in terms of spending time here, doing sort of regular hanging out with some of the groups and pulling people into what you're doing?
Yeah, it's a fortuitous coincidence that I plugged into Berkman several months ago before this need arose. So I've been participating in the Digital Natives of lunches, which have been fantastically stimulating for me. So I can easily see a two-way benefit. I know from talking to folks here that our research project would grow exponentially from the contacts we'd make. Essentially, by next year, we'll have finished this pilot stage of the project, and we'll be thinking about what comes next. And I can't think of a more stimulating environment to do that. I also feel that as sociologists and people with specific methodological and area expertise that there's a lot we can bring to the table in talking to folks from other areas who are also doing research on the internet. So of the team, Kevin, myself, and Nick Christakis are all here in Cambridge. The other two collaborators are in California. I certainly can't speak to Nick. So this is a guy, you may have heard him. He's gotten a lot of press lately for showing that obesity spreads. So he's kind of the everything spreads guy. He's incredibly busy, as you can imagine. But Kevin and I are really steering the project, at least for the next 12 months. And would love to have as much opportunity as possible to hang out here, talk to people. We'd love to give a presentation to more Berkman Center folks and get feedback about what to do next.
I'd be really curious to hear a little bit more about your privacy findings.
Uh-huh.
Just in terms of, like, kind of specifically what, so I don't know, yeah, did you look at the kind of range of privacy options and how those played out rather than just
privately? See the floor to Kevin, who's
the principal. So, as I've already acknowledged, I mean, the privacy landscape at your disposal is pretty diverse, and so we started out by just simplifying everything into those who are private profiles and not. Public profile is one that you can access. Well, rather, private profile is one you can't access in full, right? So you either get the limited search profile or one that you can't find at all. So here's kind of a problem is, you know, it's impossible to distinguish between someone who's not on Facebook and someone who's hidden themselves completely from searches. Thus, we bring in our longitudinal data. And so we define someone as private who was on our radar at time one, who disappeared subsequently, right? And so this allows us then to look at the taste, for instance, of private students, even though we can't see these people later on, right? We already have data on them. So we divided, you know, our population into the first analysis was just a basic logistic regression of privacy settings, and we found the female finding, the finding about taste popularity, activity, and the social network effect, Facebook friends, and especially your roommates. If they have private profiles, you're much more likely to. In the second part, we take a much more closer look at the tastes of people with private profiles and basically do a multidimensional scaling on these to kind of plot out where in you know, three-dimensional space where tastes are closer together if they co-appear and you know, more often you expect by chance, and further together if they, you know, co-appear less frequently. So we can show, you know, not just limited privacy, but more broadly we can basically map out the taste space of these students and then also look at which tastes tend to be more or less associated with privacy. And we see, for instance, in addition to taste being more popular among private students, these tastes are also kind of marginalized. There's not one, you know, particular type of student who has a private profile that you can say, you know, private students like XYZ. They kind of fall in a few different locations that aren't very similar themselves, but similar, you might say that, you know, people with public profiles are trying to display themselves, and people with private profiles, maybe it's not so popular, for instance, you know, everyone likes Wedding Crashers that year, and so it's not such a cool thing to display. Again, kind of a stretch here, and but the things you might interpret from these data.
I'm curious. So the research that we did obviously is really different, like really small and qualitative. But what we found in terms of privacy was very often it came about at this crux moment. So you don't think about your privacy settings, you really don't care, and then something happens to you or somebody really close to you. So maybe thinking about this roommate thing, and then suddenly you enter into this world of, whoa, okay, there's something. So I'm curious maybe about kind of longitudinally, if you have any data as far as like how long they were on Facebook and how that might affect their privacy setting.
We don't know how long they've been on Facebook. We would be able to assess the diffusion of privacy at these four points in time. But this is a case where we as quantitative researchers desperately need to talk to qualitative researchers and share ideas. An interesting wrinkle to this from a legal point of view is that we faced a dilemma as researchers in what happens if a student has privacy setting that says, you can't see me unless you're my friend. And our undergraduate research assistant who's downloading the data is a friend with that person. Is it, then can we include them in our data, or do we have to pretend and look the other way because we as the researchers aren't their friend? And the basic hurdle to doing this kind of research in the future would be negotiating away privacy settings. We approached Facebook once to ask them if they would let us see below that level and just give us the data, and they were pretty ornery about it. They've had their problems, and we're lucky they let us look.
People clicking that red button.
Exactly. But you know, if this kind of research is going to prevail, we're going to need to find some negotiated settlement where social network sites will share the data with us on the condition that we are cleaning it of any identifying information.
I mean, well, on that kind of, I'm not really optimistic.
Yeah.
But I think one thing that I think about a lot is the, not that particular site dictates behaviors strongly, although I think that it definitely does weakly, but the way that norms are formed and diverge cross-contextually. So for instance, these are popular tastes in music and only popular tastes in music in Facebook.
Yes.
And that, you know, those same students, if or on their MySpace profiles, if you were to map that, would look very different. But they're probably, most of them probably aren't on MySpace. And so what a popular music profile is on MySpace might have a totally different set of behaviors associated with it, both because of the kind of person that's there,
right,
and because of other structural factors of the medium. And so that's, I mean, for my own interest, that's one of the directions I want to try and push, is to get data sets that are collecting in several different sources over time, so that we can make those comparisons.
I mean, our dream would be to negotiate with a college and with the students therein, to get these students right before they arrive for the beginning of their freshman year and get somehow access to all the internet data they produce, relational
just,
and otherwise.
Yeah, but not just a college. That's the thing.
Well, do this as a heuristic, because once you get beyond that, you really, the analytical issues get tremendously complicated.
Absolutely, but I think if we're from the point of view of, you know, digital natives, we're not just looking at, and we want to be very clear at not just looking at college kids, and who get a lot of the attention and whose behaviors are sort of generalized across the generation. It's not the case. There are a lot of different kinds of behaviors and expressions of self that are happening outside of these college-heavy spaces.
Yeah. So this is really just a fascinating idea, being able to delve into these online communities and do this sort of quantitative research to draw these kinds of conclusions. I guess one of the worries that I would have is noise. Like the privacy question, for example, since we've been talking about that a lot, has this characteristic. It seems that, you may have judged whether they've decided to keep their profiles private or not as the metric of privacy, but there may be other metrics too, such as who downloads all the applications and who doesn't, and who posts things and who doesn't, who mentions what their tastes in music are and whatnot, not to mention this cross-linking with potential other sources. I mean, someone who links to a MySpace profile with lots of information might be in some sense less private than someone who links to an empty MySpace profile.
Absolutely. And my hunch is that groups like Facebook and Yahoo are doing this in-house.
Okay.
They want the answers to these questions. And so we're trying to find, we want advice on this, find ways to convince them to share with us. And in exchange, we would share with them anything we could learn. there's you've only scratched the surface of the data that you could glean from these sources. It's so much more, but the question is like getting to use it.
Right, but just to quickly follow up, I guess the cross-linking of the databases is exactly the privacy question, and mm-hmm. it would make sense to me if I were a Google or a Yahoo.
Right.
I would not want necessarily to give away my user data so readily.
Yeah. Now, I wonder on the other hand if it would be legal for users to volunteer their information and circumvent the sites. These are issues that are so far out of our realm of expertise that it's useful.
IMDb Netflix intersection attack.
Yeah.
It would certainly be legal, but you would have some really messy IRB issues, I think, especially when you have people who are dealing with all of these other degrees of association.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
them.
The upside is we potentially have a lot to tell college administrators as well. We know here at Harvard College, the deans of freshmen worry an awful lot about sorting students in the correct ways and avoiding some types of self-segregating behavior. And if they were to provide us their data, we could actually give them a lot of feedback about the social dynamics of being a student on their campus, including how the physical layout of their campus contributes to student life and group affiliation.
I don't know if there was anything else that you would be willing to share about the relationship between the physical space, the online space that you're able to observe through the data beyond the fact that certain online behaviors spread through physical co-location.
Right.
Was that the sort of extent of what you're able to find at this kind of pilot stage, or are there other directions you're hoping to move with it, or yeah?
We haven't looked in great details, as I was talking to Miriam previously. There's just so much here, and there's five of us on this team, and I've been working nonstop for 3 years, and still it's like I wish there were 50 hours in a day. The other way we've used the proximity data so far is in trying to model how these ties form in the first place. And so in the homophily paper, race is important for networks, race is important for networks, over and over and over again, which it is, but this has been limited in a lot of ways by the availability of data, right? And so one way we use proximity, for instance, was to show, look, race is important, but in comparison to, living with someone, it's totally trivial, right? And so, roommates do, in fact, as we would expect, tend to post more pictures of each other. And that effect of proximity also, as you'd expect, tends to decline the further away someone is from you. So the highest effect with roommates, the less with people who live in your same dorm building. And then if you kind of group the dorm buildings themselves into clusters, still in effect, but not so much. And so
there's an interesting wrinkle here. Part of the reason why we chose the campus we did is that it's almost a wholly residential college. And midway through the first year, the freshman year, these students have to pick between 1 and 7 best friends that they are then going to enter the future of their undergraduate housing. So they basically get sent off to one of several residential pods in their sophomore year. So it's a beautiful natural experiment in that the students are somewhat randomized their freshman year, and then we get to see who they pick as they're up to 7 best friends. And there, the physical dimension begins to break down, in that proximity is a predictor of affiliation, but clearly there are roommate groups that shatter and break up, and affiliations that pick up in distant parts of campus. And one of the next things we have to do is to try to predict what factors transcend proximity, and what factors break proximity, break up roommate groups, and we actually have the means to do that.
That almost implies sort of a model. I mean, the metaphors you're speaking in imply sort of a model about social relation creation and destruction. I mean, it's a very sort of, I don't know if you've based it on some particular format or if you're thinking about it systematically, but I mean, is it sort of thermodynamics? Is it,
That's an open question.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just interesting. I don't know, to hear you talking about it, that's something that comes up.
Whether your data and your methodology let you track changes over time, either changes within the same group, the same cohort, so you can see how this group of, 300 incoming freshmen change privacy settings, change whatever as a group over time, as well as sort of map similar groups. So if you can see, freshmen 4 years after the first group come in with a very different set of privacy expectations or, whatever the factors that you're looking at.
Yeah, great question. thus far, we're limited to one cohort, though we aspire in the next phase to do multiple cohorts on multiple campuses. An obvious limitation here is that we are only looking at one campus and arguably a fairly idiosyncratic campus, a very elite college that we've chosen to study. There are infinite ways you could break down our cohort for sub-analysis to look at how a select group of these students evolve and change over time. And that's one of the reasons why it's so exciting that this data will be publicly accessible, so people can bring their own personal questions to bear. And I should say, we're rather agnostic on the issue about whether this is data about social actors or data about social actors online. It's really a sort of a question of your research priorities, a Bayesian emphasis on what you think this data represents. And we've tried to provide metrics so that people can compare physical relationships to online relationships. The one real shortcoming of the data, one thing that I would change, if I could wave a wand, would be to have it so that people delete as much data as they add. The problem about Facebook is it's cumulative. You're always adding friends, very rarely deleting friends. You're always adding to your favorites, favorite movies lists, very rarely deleting. And clearly, that's not the nature of social reality, and we have no way to counteract that, short of somehow prompting people to be more sensitive.
I think one way you might be able to control for that in some way is to gauge, come up with and engage a series of sort of freshness elements of, especially of friendships and friendship tokens. So if people, say, live together and hang out a lot and are tagging each other a lot in each other's photos freshman year, and then you look at second and third pass and they're not there anymore, then you can sort of zoom in on the more socially relevant behaviors and friend groupings. It'd certainly be something that could be looked into.
Yeah, the problem is rarely, say, would somebody remove a picture. We can sort of create a timeline, because we know if a picture wasn't in wave one and it appears in wave two, that it was added sometime in the interim. And through that, we could subtract and find out what's in each wave.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other thing that would, where it would be infinitely preferable to have log data rather than just sweeps. But I guess the question I originally wanted to ask is, so assuming you don't get log data from Facebook, what is your best alternative to that? Beyond this, what else do you want to do?
Assuming we couldn't get better data, we would certainly want to examine more campuses and more diverse kind of campuses, which is something we wanted to do from the outset, but we had to scale back. The ultimate prize, even with our current limitations, would be to get these students August before they arrive in college, and then look at them again in, say, October of their freshman year, and again in February, to at least do more data draws. For 1,640 students, yeah, I'd say it was about 100 man hours to do one draw. So maybe more, and then there's one has to clean the data. So, you know, one complication we have here, Kevin knows, he sweats blood on this. You know, in the favorite music, say, some people will write Beatles, other people will write The Beatles, other people will write Sgt. Pepper's. And Kevin and Marco go through this and put all this into a uniform coding language so that our software recognizes that these are three people with the same taste in music.
People are starting to study like taste out there on you know, MySpace or whatever, but often you're looking at more data, but you're using some type of script to go through it, and so it's less refined, right?
Yeah.
And so all these instances, you might have, you know, the most popular taste in the data set is actually split in two, because half of them write Lord of the Rings and half of them write LOTR, and this might is not a, you know, it doesn't
occur
to
but I mean,
you can
normalize those chunkers and parsers.
We do, but
yeah.
This is...
it's not insignificant, but
it's
no,
very significant.
I'm just saying that, you know, because it's we're not dealing with the entire universe in MySpace, right? We are able to go more detailed and do things that people with larger data sets can't.
And we've also been using sources like Metacritic to create indices of how popular or hip or esteemed people's tastes are. And then we can compare those measures, some objective measure of whether you like art films or trashy films, to what's popular and unpopular within your class. But really, the more snapshots we could get of these students, the more we would learn about them.
Let's go back to the freshness issue. It seems that, first of all, there's something an interesting phenomenon that I noticed, which is sometimes people will actually post something that occurred well before Facebook had ever existed. So suddenly, not only will there be pictures of me that were taken yesterday at some party or random event, but there might be pictures of me that were taken in 1994 that somehow someone managed to post. And that's a bit of an interesting phenomenon as well. And as for freshness, I'm not sure whether to get people to remove photos, I would think that one would need to it would need to become a norm that removing photos or removing friends was okay. Yeah. And it would seem that would be
not. I mean, you could get a better idea of freshness if you were doing more passes, and so you could track changes in more regimented way over time. And you know, it's certainly something to consider if something like that would be an interesting issue going forward, to not do full passes, but do selective passes and look at individual profile elements and see how they've changed.
two related issues, projects that we'd like to see done. We have all these photos. It would be great to have somebody do qualitative content analysis of what type of photos people post on their Facebook page. I can tell you there are definitely some trends. People in sports teams publish a lot of photos of themselves and their teammates on trips with their team. The conventional prom dance night photos, I mean, they're definitely repertoires here.
In front of their cars.
I forgot the other agenda item I had, something that we want to do, so I'll let it stand with that. Yeah.
I apologize for skipping out in between our conversation before. But one of the things we talked a tiny bit about was if you could imagine this research project being much bigger and broader, and in fact, so what you do with it after 2 years with this particular NSF grant. And we've been thinking a lot here about the nature of interdisciplinarity in our field, however you want to define internet studies, broadly speaking. So I just wonder if, in the way that you're speculating about what would be interesting data to have, or what analysis might be interesting to have done, have you given any thought to what the kind of the grand, 10x bigger size project would look like, and how it would possibly feed into kind of proving a concept about interdisciplinary study in the field?
Yeah.
Not that you necessarily want to do that, but.
No, we would, certainly. What I would like to see next, using what we've learned here, is a second wave of data where we not only get this objective data off the web and from the college, but actually enlist members of this cohort and marry qualitative data with quantitative data, and get a variety of types of qualitative data from the students in ways that would incorporate anthropologists, people studying comparative media studies, educators and people in education school, to really try to get holistic data on the online experience of college students from as many different angles as possible. And I would think it would be doable on the right campus to negotiate this, at least with a subset of the population, and follow these students for 4 years and maybe longer, and develop a more comprehensive picture of online life than anyone has assembled thus far.
This is an issue I've been thinking a lot about how to aggregate the efforts of researchers who were working around these issues, and I think coming to some sort of contingent set of agreements over what the stuff is that we're interested in. Coming up with a general template for that sort of longitudinal research, such that 5 or 10 research teams can be doing basically the same project at different institutions all over the country. And so at the end of every year, you have both this enormously aggregated data set, snapshots in time for a single year, but also over the course of several years, you have these, a general social software survey.
That's a fantastic idea. Incorporate data yeah. would be. That's a terrific that's, idea. And maybe if it were collaborative like that, individual colleges would be more eager to participate,
yes.
as would students, because this would be...
And it'd be easier, and it'd be easier for individual teams to get IRB approval when their IRB committees see that this thing has been done before and is being done in concert with this large consortium of research universities.
No. We haven't gotten permission to talk to any of our respondents. We're just drawing their Facebook data. By far the larger issue was getting Facebook to agree, as they did in 2005. But part of the reason we want to make this data publicly accessible is we're not sure anyone will ever be allowed to do this again, at least in a way that's legal enough that you could publish the results. We've talked to computer scientists at MIT that are just scraping reams and reams of data. But from our point of view, they probably won't be able to publish the results from that because it's not IRB approved data. I was just thinking of one this morning, actually, but it has nothing related to this project whatsoever. But are you thinking as a way of collecting data?
Yeah, why do you make data collection cooperative if you're...
See, this is exactly the kind of cross-pollinization that we get by talking about the project at a place like this. I would have never thought of that in a million years, and that's probably very, very doable and could produce a lot of interesting...
The problem you run into there, of course, is sort of... The same problem you run into with privacy settings, but even larger, because not only are you not getting a representative sample of those non-private profiles, you're getting the opt-ins of people who are reasonably unconcerned about surveillance. So I've thought about the same thing, and I think for certain things it can be useful, but for this sort of a study, you really need...
Survey researchers encounter this problem all the time. Most survey research is done by telephone. And tons of us refuse to talk to a survey researcher. There are statistical techniques for compensating for the self-selection mechanism. So even though that would be a problem, you could still get usable data from it.
You could imagine getting usable data, but you could also imagine not necessarily getting the data that's most interesting. Because not only might it be people who aren't concerned about surveillance, but it could be people who, whether they're concerned about surveillance or not, have decided to do what they would otherwise do.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. So I teach this course, Media in the American Mind, and all the students have to do a research project at the end. One of my students this year interviewed Harvard undergraduates about their use of online pornography. And she had students crawling out of the woodwork wanting to talk to her about their online porn habits. And she actually interviewed a group... yes, indeed. There was a whole suite of 10 men that would share subscriptions to pornography services. They were completely open about this. They would share a password, and this was part of their social life as a roommate group, that they share pornography. That phenomenon alone was pretty interesting, pretty shocking to hear about. But the fact that students would actually talk to a researcher who's writing a paper on this means that people may be more willing to talk about their online lives than we think.
There's an analogy to this idea with a project here called the Herdict Project, which is a distributed application for collecting information about what's going on your PC. So PC health is one aspect, and the other is around censorship and network effects, what's happening on the network effectively. So it's, there might be, to the extent that you ended up going down the distributed application road, there might be some additional work that we've done in thinking about how to structure that and collect data, large data set.
I was thinking about the ID layer stuff too, just in terms of, some folks working on like ID layer stuff, which would create infrastructure for individuals to identify themselves as willing to share certain bits of information with companies about certain kinds of things, or, it doesn't have to be companies, it could be researchers as well. But yeah.
Thanks for having us. This was terrific. Yeah, thank you. This was really short notice. Thank you.